a pleasure to have Brother Tim and Sister Dawn in our midst again, and we have appreciated Brother Tim's ministry to us in the past, and we would expect a blessing from the Lord through his ministry this morning. He has chosen as his subject the Kingdom Stone. The Kingdom Stone. Brother Tim.
Good morning. It's very nice to be here with you. And we bring you the warm Christian love and greetings from the brethren out in Portland. And that is especially the friends from the retirement center and especially those who were formerly residents of Chicago. And as I'm sure you are all aware, Sister Mary Litwin died yesterday. And I'm not sure what scenario that you dream about your last days here on earth, but my ideal scenario was always to go to a convention and die the next morning. And maybe if possible, go to the general convention, some long convention, 5-6 days, and then pass away the next morning. That's exactly what happened to Sister Mary Litwin. She's been living in Portland for the last 5 years, and it's interesting that she passed away in Michigan and is so close to where she wanted to be buried, which is in Chicago, next to her husband. So, heartwarming thoughts when we see just these small overruling providences of how God takes care of His servants. Each era of the gospel age has been difficult to live in. The early church had some unique trials and experiences that went along with the historical and the social aspects of their day. The brethren who lived in the Middle Ages had other experiences that were seemingly unique to that time period. And the same is true for us. We live in the last days. And in some respects, maybe it's just our perspective, but in some respects, maybe this is the worst time. And we get that idea from 2 Timothy, the 3rd chapter, that says, in the last days, perilous times will come. 2 Timothy 3. Our days, by definition, are more evil. There are more seductions. There are more temptations. There are just literally more distractions than at any other time in the gospel age. And maybe to compensate for that, God has made a special provision for those of us living in the last days. He has allowed us to see some things by the eye of faith that no other group was privileged to see. We can see things now at this end of the age so clearly that we feel that we're almost walking by sight as opposed to by faith. In this day of incredible evil, we see prophecies fulfilled like never before. Prophecies uttered thousands of years ago. Our subject this morning is about one of those prophecies. It's definitely one of my favorites. And this prophecy was first related in a dream to the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. It was a dream about this tremendous image of a man. And then this image was violently destroyed in the dream. And you remember that this dream had an emotional impact on Nebuchadnezzar. It terrified him. Literally, it terrified this ruler of this biggest nation of the world of that time. He couldn't sleep. And then, to make matters worse, if you can figure this out at all, then he couldn't remember the dream. He couldn't remember any of the details. The only thing that was left with him was this trauma of the fear of what he had dreamed. So it was like, that's double jeopardy. So he did what he always did. He called in his magicians and his astrologers, and they just frustrated him even more. They couldn't remember it. They didn't know anything about it. They couldn't help him. He became so furious that he commanded that they all be destroyed. That was the first good thing that happened because of this dream. But you remember that there was this imported Hebrew that had come from the land of Palestine by the name of Daniel, in the king's administrative group. And he was able to remember and interpret the dream for the king. The dream was a dramatic illustration of how God was ruling the world. And it related very much to the fact that at that point in time, God was stopping, he was ending this special relationship that he had had with the nation of Israel. And this dream in Daniel 2 showed that now there would be a succession of Gentile powers. The spotlight was going to be taken off of Israel and switched over to a group that had never been very much in the spotlight. And that these Gentile powers would stay in power until God's kingdom forcefully removed them. And we know from our perspective that it was Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, then Rome, that were these universal empires dominating their entire known world. Now this prominent role of the Gentile powers, this was new. This was brand new. God had dealt before with the patriarchs. He dealt with the 12 tribes. He ignored the Gentiles. And even long after Israel abandoned Jehovah, he still dealt with them. They were still his typical people until this time period of Nebuchadnezzar. Something really changed here at this time. Jerusalem had been captured. The Babylonians tore down Jerusalem. They burned the temple. And Israel, as a political entity, went out of sight. The individual still existed, but there was no longer a government. There was no longer a leader, a king. It was gone. So now started this period of Gentile dominion, Gentile favor, we might say, Gentile rule. And by definition, as long as the Gentiles ruled, Jerusalem would be trodden down. This era began in Nebuchadnezzar's day and lasted without interruption until our day. Incredibly long time period that we're talking about. Now we got other inputs from the scriptures about this era besides the book of Daniel. In Luke, the 21st chapter and verse 24, we see this expression, which we like to put in quotation marks almost, quote, the times of the Gentiles. Speaking of this same long era of Gentile rule, the times of the Gentiles. And we see a relationship to Ezekiel 21, verses 25 and 27, of how Israel was removed, and therefore the Gentile dominion could start. And this scripture in Ezekiel 21 talks about the removal of the diadem from Israel. That was back in Nebuchadnezzar's day. And then we see, as part of this picture, in Leviticus 26, verses 14 through 21, it tells us of how Israel is going to be punished. Is going to be ignored 7 times for her sins. And we see, in a chronological sense, based on Ezekiel 4, where it tells us of this principle of the Lord of a day equaling a year in His prophetic utterances, we now see that this chronological time period of 7 times a prophetic year, 7 times 360, coming up with a very, very long time period, 2,520 years. This was to be the time of Gentile dominion. This was to be the Gentile times. Now, most of us first were exposed to this doctrine and this teaching in the second volume. Chapter 4 is where Brother Russell outlines this beautiful story, and that's where most of us learned it. Let's go back to Daniel, the second chapter, and read a few verses. You know the story well, but let's focus on verses 31 through 35. I'm reading from the New English Translation. And what we have here is Daniel is recounting to the king what his dream was. And if you can picture this scene, the king has been in great agitation and great emotional distress. The man is distraught for some period of time. And now as Daniel tells him the story, you can just see the calmness return to Nebuchadnezzar as he says, "That's what it was." As is Daniel speaking, "As you watched, O king, you saw a great image. This image, huge and dazzling, towered before you, fearful to behold. The head of the image was fine gold, its breast and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet part iron and part clay. While you looked, a stone was hewn from a mountain, not by human hands. It struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and shattered them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all shattered to fragments and were swept away like chaff before the wind from a threshing floor in summer, until no trace of them remained. But the stone which struck the image grew into a great mountain, filling the whole earth. That was the dream." What a relief for Nebuchadnezzar. Now he could sleep. So, from our perspective, all these thousands of years later, what do we have here? Do we have a dream? Do we have a prophecy? No. What we have, from our perspective, is a reality. We see by the eye of faith, we see by the eye of belief, we see by the eye of the harvest message, we have seen the stone. We have seen the stone of God's kingdom that strikes this image, that strikes this symbol of Gentile dominion for over 2,000 years. The stone has been activated. We have seen the lease of Gentile power expire. But there's details to this thing that are fun to talk about and deserve some discussion. In order to understand how this is taking place, I think we need to understand a couple principles of how God, we need to remind ourselves of a couple principles of how God works. Two for sure. Number one principle is God has a lot of time. Psalms 90 verse 4 is that beautiful poetic expression that 1,000 years in Jehovah's sight are but as a watch in the night after it's passed. Or the scripture in 2 Peter 3:8 where a day with the Lord is to us as 1,000 years, things like that. Things that you and I, if we were in charge, would try to accomplish in a day or two, God takes hundreds of years. You know, the disciples of the first Advent had the same problem. They wanted that kingdom established that week. And that was not so. That was just the beginning. That was 2,000 years ago almost. We're like, I don't know if you're familiar with the expression, there's type A behavior. You know, everything is a rush, 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 rush. Well, we're type A behavior chronologists too. We want everything done now, and we want it established in our lifetime at our convenience. But one of the great principles is that God is taking His time, and He's presently at work in the fulfillment of this great prophecy. The second thing that is a principle is that it's related, but God works through processes. And by that we mean small steps. Everything is done as a series of actions or events. There's always a sequence of changes. You could almost draw it out on a scale. And you know, that's why we have a chart, a plan of the ages. It shows God's sequences or processes. Everything is a step, a process, one after the other. So God and His agents, they supervise things, they direct things, they overrule, but they don't seem to force things. There's no instantaneous events. No instantaneous miracles. That's a good example is the restoration of Israel. It didn't happen in a week. It didn't happen in a day. It took years. Small beginning. Steps. One by one. Same thing is true with the call, the completion of the church. Didn't happen in 3.5 years. No. God worked small steps. Processes. There was no instantaneous bang or big bang theory. And one of the most significant teachings, I think, presented by Brother Russell, something that was, from our perspective, an incredible prediction, was that the Gentile times would end in 1914. That the image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream would be struck in 1914. And based on the captivity beginning in 606, based on the time period of 2,520 years, the mathematics indeed come out precisely to 1914. So to the eye of faith, the kingdom stone struck the image in 1914. Historians agree. Political scientists agree. Sociologists agree. Psychologists agree that something incredible happened in 1914. Before we look at some of those details, I would just like to ask the question, do you realize why the image existed at all? Why was there this Gentile time period? It's almost like, why bother? Why was this government, world government situation, why was this image time period there at all? We need to understand why it was there if we're going to really understand why it was removed. It's the key that we understand as part of the permission of evil. God was again allowing man to rule himself. He was giving fallen man the opportunity to see if he could bring order to this earth. We know the answer. It's futile. Israel was given a chance. They could have become the kingdom here on earth. They thought they could do all those things. They failed miserably. But you know, if only Israel had been given a chance, you know what the Gentiles would have said? You know what the Babylonians would have said? You know what the Greeks would have said with all their philosophy? You know what the Romans would have said with all their organization? Oh, if only we had the chance, we could have done it. It was all part of a educational, self-governing, but very futile attempt to bring order to the world. And you and I know very well the only remedy was God's kingdom. What would we accept as proof that this image representing the Gentiles was struck? What would we have to see to say, oh, okay, it must have happened? I would say that we would hope for something dramatic. We would hope for something that was really clear and not subtle and not hidden. We would like to see something just as dramatic at the end of the image as was at the beginning of the image when Nebuchadnezzar took over Jerusalem. It was pretty dramatic. Knocked down the walls, broke down the gates, burned the temple, took all the people captive. We're talking about major league war. We would hope at this end of the image that we would see these Gentile powers visibly shaken. We would hope that the people who are ruling, the countries that are ruling, would maybe be removed in a big dramatic war. That would make it easy to spot. And almost incredibly, when you think of how many subtle changes God has worked through the ages, and how even when Jesus came, He was missed by a lot of the people. Something happened in 1914 that no historian, no sociologist, no psychologist, no political scientist has missed. They've all seen it. We have seen that absolute power of the Gentile times delivered a death blow in 1914. 1914 stands like a pinnacle in the history of man. The world changed. That old order, oh, that would turn to shambles. And it's not just our opinion. The historians say across the board that the world changed in 1914. Historians look at countries. They say those huge colonial empires, literally the 10 toes of that image, they say they don't exist anymore. And now what we have are a multitude of self-governing countries. Multitude, hundreds of countries. Political scientists like to look at the structure of governments. They don't care about countries. They say the structure of governments changed in 1914. Where we had absolute rulers in 1914. Now, it's totally changed. We have government by consensus. Consensus of the people. Sociologists don't like to look at countries. They don't like to look at government structures. Sociologists like to look at the people. and the social groups. They say society changed in 1914. What was closed before, now we have open society. I'm just giving you the big picture, the big words that they use. Read their books and see how they feel about this. Even the scientists say that the world changed in 1914. Science changed? Yes, read their books. Pre-1914, Newton's laws ruled. After 1914, Newton's laws no longer ruled. It was Einstein's theory of relativity. The scientific world changed in that same era. Incredible changes took place with that great war where 15 million people were killed. And I read recently now that psychologists point to 1914 as the major change in man's view of himself and of the family unit. Historians, sociologists, political scientists, psychologists all point to 1914. But who knows why? Brethren, we are of the small group that knows why it changed in 1914. And what has caused this incredible change? It's a stone! A stone. Daniel 2:35. A stone that grows into a great mountain and fills the earth. Now we notice right away in trying to figure out what this stone is that it's a very earthly thing. You see that the stone grows into something. The stone comes out of something that's here on earth and the stone grows into something that's here on earth. There's no mention here of the heavens. I think that's key in trying to figure out what this is. We notice also that it's different than the preceding empires, all of which are metallic substances. The gold, the silver, and all those things. Metallic, you know, the metals had to be processed, they had to be mined, they had to be refined. To me, the metal are man-made products. And we see that's different. The stone, is a natural product. It's not something that man puts together. We like the idea that mountains represent kingdoms, that this mountain grows into a great kingdom. And in keeping with the image concept, you know, the image was representing universal empires. We see that the mountain then becomes another universal empire. It's the fifth universal empire. It's God's universal empire. In looking at this stone, we might ask, is the stone Jesus? I would say very technical sense, no. He's not exactly the stone, because the stone stays here on earth, becomes the kingdom. Jesus is a spirit being. Is the stone the church? Well, no, they're spiritual also. They're part of the spiritual administration. The stone stays here on earth and becomes the mountain. It doesn't say that the stone then goes up to heaven. So, more than anything, the stone is the earthly dominion, the earthly authority, the earthly rulership, the new lease of the fifth universal empire. Now, who directs the stone? Jesus, the church, etc. So, the control or the management is from the spiritual phase. But the stone is a very earthly illustration. Even the key dates that we associate with the second presence, 1874, they're different than the key dates we see of the earthly phase of this operation. The stone, the dates for the stone are around 1914. But the dates for the spiritual phase are around 1874. The return of our Lord, the raising of the sleeping saints. We see spiritual dates and spiritual level up here. We see the story of the stone coming later, 1914, an earthly picture. So I would say what we saw in 1914 was the beginning of the dominion of the fifth universal empire. How dramatic were those changes in 1914? One of the great empires was the German Empire. It was one of the offshoots of the Holy Roman Empire, going back hundreds of years. The territory stretched before the war of over 1 million square miles. After the war, 180,000 square miles. A fraction, 10% of what it was before. The great Austria-Hungary Empire lost 3/4 of their population just in the span of the war. The Russian Empire of the Tsars lost 24 million people. The Ottoman Empire was cut in half. The world exploded after the war into something we call self-determination. There were new republics formed at that time. Czechoslovakia, Poland, Yugoslavia, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, the Irish Free State, they all came back, or they all were self-determined then. Now, did everything disappear overnight? No. That's not one of God's principles. Were there no signs left of the iron and clay of the toes? No. That's not how God works. There were plenty of signs left there. But we see in Daniel 7, in the 12th chapter, we see another picture of this dominion. This time, it's almost a more accurate picture in the sense that these governments are represented as beasts. Ugly beasts. And it says in the 12th verse, reading from the New English, "The rest of the beasts, though deprived of their sovereignty, were allowed to remain alive for a time and a season." So they weren't instantaneously removed. I would paraphrase that by saying, after 1914, the Gentile powers, though deprived of their sovereignty, were allowed to remain alive for a time and season. So 1914 hit more like a birth spasm, a la Matthew 24, verse 8, where it says that all of this is but the beginning of birth spasms. So from that analogy, we would expect to see wave after wave of birth pangs. And we also see the same steps, the same process in the dream in Daniel 2. First, there's the striking. That's in verse 34. But very importantly, we see in the next verse, there's an action called grinding or shattering to pieces. That's a time-consuming process. The fragments, King James says, breaking to pieces. This action must break, grind, pulverize the elements of that image until, as verse 35 says, they become like powder, chaff, fine powder, that when you throw it up into the air, the wind takes it away. That's the last step. Striking is one step, then there's the grinding, the pulverizing, then there's the blowing away. In the fragments of those universal Gentile powers, there were still lots of man-made ideas left. Ideas that men still wanted to try to govern themselves. There were still attempts that needed to fail before God's kingdom could be established. And so, there was fascism. Fascism is a totalitarian concept. It's not a whole lot different than the absolute rulership of the divine right of kings that took place during the Gentile times. But in this case, mankind did not use a genetic succession of king to his son, king to his son, etc. But in this case, with fascism, very powerful men almost power mad men exploited their fellow men with a strong centralized government. They suppressed all opposition. We're talking about people like Mussolini, Hitler, and Franco. Those governments exposed the hatefulness of men governing other men. God allowed them to try this modification of the absolute authority of the Gentile times. But the kingdom stone had struck, and fascism failed also. And as those fascist governments failed, the kingdom stone grew just a little bit bigger. Another form of government that had to be tried and had to fail was socialism. Great Britain, certainly one of the toes of the great image, embraced socialism like no other country on the face of the earth. It failed. And one of the world's greatest empires has shriveled to a third-rate power, its energy sapped by all its attempts at socialism. Around the world, the trappings of socialism have so bogged down the governments in expense and inefficiency and in corruption that government after government is replacing socialism with something they're calling private enterprise. There are many books out now that talk about the demise of socialism and that socialism as a concept of governments is finished. This was a benevolent approach of man trying to rule man. This was contrast to fascism, which was a brutal approach. Swinging away from that, mankind said, let's be nice to one another. But socialism has failed, and the kingdom stone grows a little bit larger. Have you seen the kingdom stone? Were you alive in 1914 when the Great War started? Did you see that stone strike the image? If you weren't alive in 1914, were you alive in 1945 when the fascist governments of Europe were crushed? If you weren't alive or aware in 1945, were you alive in the 1980s? And did you see the governments ruled by socialism crumble before your very eyes? The world sees it too. They see the demise of all these systems, but they don't know what's going on. We see it by the eye of faith. We see it as the kingdom stone. But it's not finished yet. There's another form of government that had to be tried and had to fail. It was called communism. Since 1920, another totalitarian attempt of man to rule man. This one promised the benefits of socialism with the efficiency of the fascists. Here we have 3% of the people ruling like despots. And now, in our lifetime, in the space of a year, almost overnight, we have seen the downfall of communism. The communistic countries are in economic, political, emotional chaos. They're begging other countries to help them. If you weren't alive in 1914, if you didn't see 1945, if you missed what happened in the 1980s with socialism, certainly you have seen the kingdom stone smash one of the strongest ideologies that Satan has ever promulgated, that the world does not need God's kingdom. It was called communism. He had millions of people believing that communism was the answer to the world's woes. That idea has been smashed by the kingdom stone. The kingdom stone is growing, brethren, before our eyes. Now, as an aside, we see that the Western world, European countries, North America, are the most advanced in this shattering process. The Western world has gone through fascism, socialism, communism. Now, the entire world is not in sync with the Western world. If you look at the third world countries, they're still behind us a generation or two. They're still going through fascist governments. The whole world is not going through the steps at the same time. Third world, second world is behind. Iraq is a fascist government. They still have to go through that step. There are countries in South America and in Africa, clearly fascist governments. They will be removed. They will go through the process even faster than the Western world. And now the watchword is democracy. Since 1914, the world has been leaping and lurching towards something called self-determination. This is man's yearning to be free, to control his own destiny. So now all you hear about are democracy, elections, free enterprise, free market economy. Can you believe that the country of Albania had free elections this year? That country that was so sequestered and so dominated and so ruled with the iron fist, they had elections this spring? Everybody wants democracy. But do you know what? The world must learn that despite all of its advantages, democracy is no substitute for God's kingdom. There's a big lesson yet to be learned. Democracy too must fail and must give way to God's kingdom. So don't be fooled. Democracy is not the last step. The next step can be seen in the countries that have gone through the steps most completely. It can be seen in the countries that have already experienced democracy for perhaps 200 years. Democracy is breaking down into smaller and smaller fragments. What used to be a two-party system is gone. Now it's multiple parties. What used to be representative democracy, where people were willing to send a representative to Washington, that's gone. Now they all want to participate back home. The foundation of selfishness and greed will make all these attempts at self-government fail. So what's the next step after democracy? Well, you see it in the democratic countries. You see it in the paralyzed legislatures of the Western world. You see it in the corporations. You see it in the schools. What you see are the seeds of anarchy. Every man wants to be by himself. Every man is an island. No one wants to be told what to do. He wants to decide everything himself. Governing will become impossible. The entire world must go through this process. And the kingdom stone continues to grow as this happens. The grinding of the great stone of Daniel 2 will continue until every man-made idea has failed. Glasnost must fail. Perestroika must fail. Disarmament must fail. Diplomacy must fail. And all these things you have been witness of. You have seen this take place, and you, amongst all people, have understood why. That this is the beginning, after all these hundreds and thousands of years of the establishment of God's kingdom. God has let you see this because you live in the last days. You live in perilous times. So as you struggle with the world, and as you struggle with your consecration, don't lose sight of these incredible prophetic things that are happening before your very eyes. And let the energy of the prophecies being fulfilled fill you with zeal as you run the last days of your race. May God help you to be faithful to your vows and to hear the well done at the end of the road. It's been a pleasure to be with you.